All right, thanks, Neil. So yeah, so I'm gonna start out just this. I want this to be a really informal talk. You guys should tell me to speed up or slow down as needed. I'm gonna start out doing a lot of Blackboard stuff and then sort of move to the projector. So hopefully that will work. Can people on both sides of the room see both sides of the board? More or less? Okay.
If you turn the light on.
Okay. So yeah, I wanted to start with the setup. And then I want to do and remind everybody what the basic framework is that we're considering when we talk about dark forces. And then I will summarize some of the parametrics for different kinds of decay modes of dark sector particles into normal standard model particles, and then a long list of experiments that can test them. Hopefully going through the decay modes will provide some order to that list. So the basic setup is just that dark matter interacts with the standard model through a new gauge force. It's mediated by some gauge boson that I'll call A prime. And this, the standard model is actually neutral under the A prime, but so you have your dark matter, has some A prime vertex, but there's kinetic mixing of the A prime with the photon, so it can couple to standard model particles through this. This basic mixing mechanism was discussed by Holden. There's just some kinetic term that is a mixture of the standard model field strength and the new sector field strength. And so this has been discussed as an interesting dark matter model for many reasons by many of the organizers, by Maxime's group. And basically the appeal of this is twofold. One very important feature, it's threefold. Okay. So as far as cosmic ray E plus and E minus anomalies, read that slash however you want. There's two nice features of this kind of setup. One is that you have Sommerfeld enhancement of the annihilation cross section. So you can have a much higher annihilation rate in our galaxy than the thermal one and still preserve a nice thermal freeze-out picture for where the dark matter came from. And the other is that when the dark matter annihilates, it's annihilating through diagrams like this into the new gauge boson. And these guys now, I should say that the mass of the A prime that we're thinking about is around the GeV scale. So now these things can't decay to protons. They decay to electrons, muons, they can decay to pis. But because of that, but whatever standard model, they can also have more complicated decay modes. Whatever they decay into, we know that the mass of the standard model state has to be less than the mass of the A prime. So if this is a GeV, you never get, say, PP bar out of it. And then, in addition, it's very easy in this kind of model, especially if it's non-abelian, it's very easy to generate slittings of the dark matter states. You can generate slittings that are parametrically some power of alpha times either alpha to the 1 or alpha squared, depending on exactly the parametrics, times the mass of the A prime. You can generate slittings of order the mass squared over basically a GeV scale mass, either the dark matter mass or some higher dimension operator mass. Both of these naturally, both of these parametrics tend to give you splittings around 100 keV to 1 MeV, which are good if you want to say that dark matter is scattering inelastically, or that you have some sort of exciting dark matter explanation for the integral anomaly. So there's certainly reasons to think that this is an interesting thing to think about dark matter-wise. More importantly, if it's correct, it's a new gauge force at the GeV scale, and we'd certainly want to know about that directly. So really, we can now, for the rest of this talk, almost all of the rest of this talk, forget about this side and just look at this part of the story, the light gauge boson and its interactions with the standard model, and how you can go about probing that, what's already constrained it. So now, let me just outline some decay modes in their parametrics. And this will basically be the organizing structure of the talk.
So this is, can you write just a bit further to the right?
Yeah. All right, I'll keep the title there. It just says decays. You won't miss it. So there's the simplest decay mode. Basically, if this gauge boson is the lightest thing around, it can't decay to anything lighter that's charged under it.
So I'll just go back to the
even further. All right. Is this whole panel good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, just raise the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I want to keep this up when the screen goes back down. So. So okay, I can go to L plus L minus, plus pi minus, etc. In this case, we're talking about a lifetime around that goes like 1 over alpha, mass of the A prime times epsilon squared, where epsilon is the strength of the kinetic mixing. And I'm going to pick as a sort of reference point epsilon around 10 to the minus 4, mass around a GeV. For this reference point, the C tau works out to about 10 microns. So this is a very prompt decay. You wouldn't be able to measure it in a detector. I should say, by the way, that this epsilon, I mean, I just wrote down this parameter, didn't say what a reasonable range for it is. It's extremely reasonable for it to be small. There's a symmetry limit when epsilon goes to zero. You can naturally generate it at high scales from loops of heavy particles that are charged under both. And depending on the model, you can get anywhere from roughly 10 to the minus 2 out of this kind of perturbative generation. That's on the high end to, I think it's very easy to get to write down models where it would be as small as 10 to the minus 5, even for a simple dark sector.
And if not a billion, you can get even smaller than
that,
right?
And if, right. So I'm talking about having a part that's a billion. Mm-hmm. And in that case, even if that's embedded in a gut at some other scale with some non-abelian, so there's a gut in the standard model and gut in the dark sector, you would be talking about epsilons down at the 10 to the minus 7 range, or conceivably even smaller. So, the C tau will scale appropriately. If you take small enough epsilon, then even the simple decay mode, which I will call simple and prompt, because for most of the parameter space we think about, it's simple and prompt. But if you take small enough epsilon, it becomes a rather long-lived decay. Now, one can also imagine that there is, as Neil was mentioning, some non-abelian sector. You can have decays where the A prime just goes into that non-abelian sector, say, into W's, and then everything is mixed. You have charge breaking, the whole works. So these W's decay back to L plus L minus, again, or pi's. So you have four standard model particles in the final state here. And the C tau is comparable. Again, alpha m epsilon squared. But it's now the sort of the effect of epsilon for the W's. So this is, in most models, it's down by some mixing angle, and you're talking about something slightly longer, maybe of order 1 millimeter. Now I guess I'm blocking you guys with that wall. Sorry. You can also imagine that you can also talk about Higgs bosons that naturally decay to two of the eight primes. And again, the C tau. Now for the Higgs, it's decaying to two things lighter than itself. There's no epsilon involved. So the C tau for the Higgs is equal to zero. And then you also have the A prime. So this is prompt. So these two I can classify as complex decay modes, but also typically prompt.
So the A prime decay,
I'm just saying zero for the Higgs to go into the two A primes if they're on shell. Then you have to add on the C tau of the A prime. I was just talking about the Higgs part, which is why I added this C tau of A prime there.
What is the data there in the middle?
Basically the mixing angle between, if your kinetic mixing is dominated by the U1 gauge boson, then it's the mixing angle between the non-abelian guy and the abelian one.
Okay.
And in this case, again, for this to actually work, you need the analog of charge breaking. So we're talking about a W plus or minus mixing with the heavy photon. But that happens, that often happens at loop level, so those things can be small. But there's nothing wrong with it.
But it's not a billion part, it's heavily model dependent, right?
If
you stick to the minimal model, then you have just first process and the third process, and the second is not there. Because at the first setup, you know, there are infinite directions, the model building directions you can make.
There's no reason to stick to the simplest model, right? You want to classify what can happen in generic models that get the astrophysics
right.
Then
you should go back to the same place where you draw the kinetic mixing and start gauging all possible things that have no anomalies and so on. And there are at least, 15 or 20 such combinations in the standard model, right?
All right, so it's a matter of philosophy how general you want to be. I think focusing on one operator and that mixes the standard model with another sector and analyzing complicated or simple sectors with that operator is a reasonable approach, so that's the one I'm adopting. Other operators are certainly interesting, but I'm just going to stick to this. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each of these modes. I'm just trying to categorize the range of possibilities. If I were doing something heavily model dependent, focusing on this above everything else, that would be different. But it's just an example of what can happen. Likewise, another example of what can happen is, so we can imagine what happens now depending on the mass, relative masses of the Higgs and the gauge bosons. This is what you get for the mass of the Higgs greater than twice the mass of the gauge boson, so that both of the decay products are on shell. If it's between the gauge boson mass and twice the gauge boson mass, then you have to go through one off-shell guy into two leptons. And this has a C tau, so it's again a four lepton mode, but with very different parametrics. And here the C tau goes again, it has an extra alpha. It has a dark sector alpha and a standard model sector alpha, epsilon squared. And in addition, there's an important pi factor in the numerator that one would do well to remember. And this naturally gives you C taus for the parameters I picked around 10 centimeters. So one can easily, as you vary epsilon or vary the mass a little bit, imagine this going from still being a more or less prompt decay or something with a nice observable vertex in a collider to something that's decaying on a 1 meter times on a 1 meter length scale and escaping the detector before it decays. So this is in a sort of intermediate range, and the Higgs isn't the only case we should consider here. Again, if you have some fermions in town that are split by less than the 8 prime mass and decay to one another, then you would have a similar decay, but where this is invisible, and this goes to L plus or minus, or pi's. Similar decay length. So this is now, I'd say, pretty firmly long-lived on a collider physicist's length scale.
What does star mean?
Huh?
What does star mean?
So by star, I just mean that it's an off-shell particle.
Oh, off-shell, okay.
And then the final, so this is long-lived, but it still has this epsilon squared parametrics. You can get much longer length lifetimes for the Higgs, so maybe I should go back to this side. Just very quickly. If you now talk about a Higgs that's lighter than everything else in the sector, it's lighter than the A prime, not necessarily by a lot, but even if it's right below it, then the dominant decay is this two-body decay through two off-shell A primes. And the thing about this is that now each of these, you need kinetic mixing on both of these to get a decay. So the C tau goes like 1 over m, lots of alphas, three powers of alphas. There's some mass to mass ratios that suppress it. But the most important thing is that there's a big epsilon to the fourth. So this gives you lifetimes easily for the same kind of scenario of around, sorry, for those representative numbers, it's 10 to the 12 centimeters. Okay, so that's the range of lifetimes that you need to consider if you want to study this business and reach some kind of conclusions about whether it's right or not, all the way from 10 microns to 10 to the 12 centimeters, or, you know, of order the Earth-Sun distance. And if you want to study smaller epsilons...
You probably mean C tau gamma is going to be 10 to the 12.
No, I mean C tau. This is with epsilon of 10 to the minus 4.
Well, that's a problem, right, with cosmology right away.
Well, 100 seconds, right? I thought for this kind of leptonic decay mode, the problem started kicking in around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 seconds.
Well, you're incorrect, six. Right? You're incorrect, because at 100 seconds, this thing will dominate the energy density, right? Because it will be populated fully, and it starts dominating. And at 1 MeV, which is 1 second, you have to have this subdominant. So it's not the total energy density that makes you pay for it. Because
I don't want to make too strong of assumptions about the cosmological history that this came from.
So you want to have a non-standard cosmology after 1 second? That's what you're saying.
No, I mean.
But you will in this model.
Depends on what I had before, right? Anyway, I agree this is long, and in fact, that is the next thing I was going to say. I don't know exactly where the boundary is. I really thought it was fine up to longer, but we can discuss that later.
So this one is a case where the tree level seems to go down, and only the lead thing is the leading.
Well, so there is a four-body decay that's tree level as well, right? The point is, you need there's no. And this is a bit of a cheat.
What parameter are you changing?
In literally this model, the only way that the Higgs of the dark sector doesn't directly couple to the standard model. So the only way it gets to us is through two gauge bosons. Once they both have to be off shell, you're stuck with some epsilon to the fourth scaling. The
so this is where the Higgs is lying in the gauge boson?
This is when the Higgs is lighter. And this decay is significantly faster over all of parameter space than the four-body decay. Now, what I've left out is that when you're talking about something this long-lived, it is really unreasonable to say this is the only operator, especially because, for example, in supersymmetric theories, the same mechanisms that are generating this epsilon are also generating a D term. There's all kinds of quartic couplings around between that Higgs and our Higgs. It's a new parameter, but for sort of reasonable scalings of that parameter, they give comparable, slightly faster lifetimes. This is certainly a region that you want to be where you have to be careful of cosmology, but where it's going to turn out. See, the thing about long lifetimes is that once you get to long lifetimes, you can start talking very inclusively about the constraints. So this is not a very interesting range of lifetimes. It's multiply constrained.
I'm just asking a question. The dark matter doesn't annihilate directly. Over there, you have something where A prime goes to leptons, right? Because the dark matter annihilated into A prime and then. I guess I'm asking how you produce these things.
You can write down models where these are produced by the A prime decay, since it's lighter. You can also, in colliders, you can produce the Higgs directly. There's a simple diagram. This is something that Maxime and Brian Battelle and Adam Ritz pointed out. If you just have E plus E minus, right, you can go through an off-shell leptons to produce an A prime and a dark Higgs. This is a very model-independent diagram, and it would produce these things. It's more model-dependent to ask to consider A prime decays. You need multiple Higgses in order to allow it. So it's not as generic that it's to be produced by dark matter annihilation, but you can certainly arrange it, and it wouldn't be any problem because we're talking about dark matter on much longer distance scales than this decay anyway. It wouldn't be a problem except for the cosmological issues.
Well, if dark matter has a spin, right, then there is always a possibility of annihilating into A prime and the Higgs.
There certainly is.
Can I just ask about the A prime annihilation? So in the early universe, if you really have such a high density of these, they'll annihilate with themselves too, right?
Yeah.
Maybe on a much shorter time scale than the decay lifetime, constraint.
H in this case is the lightest particle in this new sector.
It doesn't have to be the lightest particle, it just has to be heavier, lighter than a 2 Ma, right?
Well, who is
it?
Yeah.
This has to be lighter than Ma.
You're going to talk about how these are produced in the first place,
yeah,
in the experiments, right?
Yeah, and I'm going to take the approach. I mean, let's take this as an upper bound on what's relevant. We can write down models where it's produced there, where you get these long lifetimes. There are cosmological constraints coming in from the high lifetime region. There are astrophysical constraints that come in at lower lifetimes than that. Really, the only point of this was to motivate a couple of scenarios and to give a range. And also to point out that there's simple and there's complex decay modes. Both of them are important and worth thinking about. So how do we produce these things in colliders? For the most part, this diagram that I just erased is a very, very good thing to look for. It is being looked for, but for the most part, I'm going to focus on the vector, just so that we can ask a manageable problem. How does the vector decay? How can we search for it? If you can rule out all possible decays of the vector, then you have ruled out all models. That's a slightly more manageable problem than ruling out all possible decays of every conceivable particle in the new sector. So for that reason, I'm mostly going to focus on the production of the vector. And all of these productions are just going to come from the E plus E minus A prime vertex stuck into various places. So there's E plus E minus colliders, flavor factories. There's electron collisions on a fixed target. And then you have your electron beam, then you have some heavy nucleus in the fixed target. You get a photon off that nucleus, just going off its electric field. And now you can radiate off the A prime. This turns out to be a very high cross-section way of producing it, and you can also get large rates in this fixed target experiment. So then you just look. This is in the real spatial picture. You would just look for two leptons coming off from the target, or possibly with a displaced vertex, or for these more complicated decay modes with a displaced vertex. There's a generalization of this, which is, so this, here we have data, most of which hasn't been completely analyzed for this physics. It's been analyzed primarily for B physics. But there is data ready and willing to be analyzed. There are people working on it. So there are a few analyses that have been done. I will mention them. There are many more analyses that can be done and hopefully will be done soon. This fixed target business with the thin target like I drew is new. There are experiments being proposed in the very near future. Philip Rubin and I have been pretty heavily involved with this. But there is no data right now. There is very limited data right now on this for the electrons, or even for protons. There's a second category there where there's tons of data. So in the 80s, there were a lot of beam dump experiments, which means just take this target, extend it into a thick block, say 10 centimeters, to 100 meters long, collide electrons into it, or collide protons into it. We also have modern-day neutrino factories, which are beam dumps, even though we don't call them that. And then you have some vacuum, some low-density area, and a bunch of detectors out here. So the idea is that you're going to produce. These were motivated, in the 80s, these were motivated by searches for axions. In particular, there was some anomaly at GSI that motivated a 1.8 MeV axion. So everyone really went to town looking for it and set wonderful limits on these kinetically mixed gauge bosons as well. The idea is that you produce whatever this particle is. So this target, this shield here is thick enough to stop the beam and stop everything that it produces. But if you happen to produce some A prime or an axion through this mechanism, and then it has a long lifetime, it'll just travel through the shield, travel into this area, and then decay. And depending on how the experiment is instrumented, seeing either a single one of these tracks or a pair of tracks will give you evidence for some new physics particle production. Not seeing it lets you rule out some parameter space. So there is a ton of data in these beam dumps, and all one has to do is interpret it. Now, the fourth kind of constraint that I'm going to talk about is not really a constraint on the low energy sector that we were talking about. It's really a constraint on the dark matter story tied to this sector. So here we have some density of electrons and protons that through their very weak interactions produce a new gauge boson. But if we just accumulate enough dark matter together, and it has some reasonable coupling to this gauge boson, then when the dark matter annihilates into it, we can look for signals of that as well. And we have just such an accumulator of dark matter. It's called the sun. And this epsilon mediates a pretty substantial coupling, a pretty substantial scattering cross-section for the dark matter. Over a large range of epsilons, it's comparable, in a very reasonable area, it's comparable to the Damis scattering cross-section. So we're talking about things like 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared per nucleon. So you capture a lot of dark matter in the sun to the tune of 10 to the 24, even 10 to the 26 particles per second, and then they annihilate. This is sort of similar. So now you're producing, again, you're producing these particles in the sun. For various reasons, if they decay promptly inside the sun to the stuff we're talking about, you don't see anything. Right? If you decay to electrons inside the sun, they just stop in there. If you decay to muons inside of the sun, they also stop. And similarly for pions, all of them are sufficiently long-lived relative to their interaction length scale, and the sun is sufficiently thick to them that anything that you produce inside the sun stays in the sun, loses its energy. Obviously, there are tails that go out, but those are not extremely significant. Now, if you have something that decays outside the sun, though, then of course you have the sun as a giant factory for whatever these things are decaying to. And if they decay to electrons, then you have final state radiation producing a big photon flux from the sun. If they're decaying to muons, then you also have, well, and you also can see directly the some electron and positron flux. For the capture rates I was talking about, 10 to the 24 per second, these fluxes are typically high compared to the total, even though it's all coming from the sun, high compared to the total flux that the that Fermi has observed. So one can set limits from that. One can set limits from Fermi's and Milagro's direct observations of the sun in gamma rays, and the fact that they don't have huge, long, high-energy gamma ray spectra. And then if you're producing muons, you can also set limits from neutrinos. So this gives us the whole range of length scales that we wanted, from very short lifetimes of colliders to looking for things that go 100 meters or 10 to the 11 centimeters to leave the sun. So I will just quickly plug the workshop that we organized at Slack. If you want to know more about dark forces, there are probably 50 talks up on this website.
What's that graphic? Who made that graphic?
Reuben made that graphic. Can you remind us what the two pieces are?
It's a combination of dark matter dissemination in the background and an event, I think, in Atlas or something.
So this is going on in other stars too, but that's not visible.
Yeah, that's too far away for us to see a significant flux. But it should be going on in every star. So these are constraints. Again, 10 to the 24 or higher is the sort of production rate of interest. And fluxes excluded from gamma rays, from electrons, and from neutrinos are all several, roughly, say, four orders of magnitude.
Can you turn off the front middle light?
I can turn off the side lights. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are gamma ray constraints, Fermi electron flux constraints, and neutrino constraints on the neutrino slide. Everything on here is really an exclusion. the lines vary a bit depending on what kind of cascade, how complicated a cascade you assume, but this is all within one order of magnitude. This super K obviously is a constraint, and Antares and Ice Cube are not on neutrinos. So there's a lot of parameter space being probed in the case the dark matter annihilates into this long-lived stuff. There's a lot of parameter space being probed by these experiments. There's another, and you can view these, I got these constraints from a paper by Mead et al. You can draw these as constraints just on the C tau and the annihilation rate times branching ratio. And they're pretty significant. These green and blue lines correspond to ice cube sensitivity. And these inner lines are sort of cool, because this is a region of sensitivity where you could see this not just through an excess of neutrinos coming from the sun and ice cube, but through events where you see two muons from a decay in or right near ice cubes simultaneously. So you can really identify this as a decay process.
What are the vertical ones?
These are two models with slightly different parametrics, and I don't remember which ones they are. So if you go to a particular model like the scalar decay that I wrote down, this is not to be taken too seriously because it is just one decay mode, but it gives you some illustration of the sensitivity. There is about an order of magnitude of epsilons where you have constraints from, the strongest constraints end up coming from these FSR limits, and over a wide range of masses, there is some excluded region. It moves with the dark matter mass. It moves with the decay lifetime, and so on.
Is that charm region existing constraints?
That charm is an existing constraint. So I'll say more about that in a second. So I believe, actually, I may have gotten the energy wrong. Is it 400 GeV? Do you remember? Yeah. Okay. So charm is one of these beam dump experiments. They dumped 400 GeV protons around 10 to the 21 of them, or as our referee pointed out, about a, how does that work? they dumped 10 to the 19 of them, didn't they?
Yeah.
About a Planck mass of protons. I'm sure this is meaningless.
Coulomb of charge is more impressive.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Although there's a slack beam dump that dumped 30 coulombs of charge. So they had a detector that actually looked very much like this. They had a copper target, and then about 100 meters downstream, a veto plane. Then they had a detector over here. The veto plane meant that any junk that came out of their target area, already visible, they could rule out. So they were really very sensitive to things decaying to EE, mu mu, or gamma gamma in this long decay region. And they didn't see any candidate events. So you can use that to set some exclusions as a function of the lifetime and the production rate. So they're somewhat mass dependent. I've shown them for masses between roughly half a GeV and 4 GeV on this plot, assuming various benchmark points for the dark sector couplings and the A prime mass. And this is roughly the range of where you would expect the lifetime to be in this particular model. So you can see basically from wherever these curves intersect the gray line, that region of C taus, or the region viewed horizontally of epsilons, are excluded. This is for a case where you have a very high production cross section for the long-lived states because the A prime is decaying to them. You also get constraints, but they're considerably weaker if you're producing through this Higgs prime Strelung process, just because there's an extra weak coupling in town, and it's two body rather than one body production. So as I said, I'm just going to focus on what the vector can do. And a long-lived Higgs is still quite consistent if the vector doesn't decay this way. But if the vector doesn't decay this way, I know that it has to decay some other way, and that's good enough for me. Yeah.
So is there any use in the veto planes? Like, does this, are you only sensitive to things that decay? You know, are you just looking at the signal where it decays outside of the shield? Or is there any way in which you can kind of say, well, they have some events where maybe things appear in the shield very late, and then there would be some?
Well, this region is really order one of the length scale, so you don't care too much about that. It's much better to just do the clean experiment. So they use the vetoes.
Yeah, because muons would be a huge problem, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is long enough that you do stop a fair number of the muons, too, but if you see something, you want to know that it's not just a muon.
You're dumping a coulomb of charge.
Yeah, and there's always a possibility that you have, you know, some other thing that travels a long time and then generates a muon further downstream and so on.
Right.
So you need a clean veto for that. And all right, this is just same plot for the people on the left-hand side of the room. But I mean, basically, if you have these, the point I just want to make is that if there's a long-lived decay, then you have a lot of constraints that you have to worry about, both these solar ones and the direct production and beam dumps. There are these two. If you're willing to go to masses above a GeV, there are certainly regions that one could live in this parameter space. These guys are sufficiently prompt that that any kind of model-independent analysis in B factories looking for vertices displaced by a weird amount should be able to probe this. It's pretty high epsilon. There's a this region here. Let me say this region here is first of all getting very constrained by cosmology, and further solar data will improve it. This region here is probably the hardest one to probe in this scenario, because the upper limit on these solar contours is set by the lifetime being less than the typical boost by gamma C tau in the sun being less than the size of the sun. As you lower it, as you lower the lifetime, the signal gets cut exponentially. Whereas at longer lifetimes, it only gets cut by a power law. So it's really hard to imagine pushing these limits up. You can push these limits down, but for these high masses, there's really nothing that I've found that has that sensitivity, that actually has sensitivity better than CHARM. There are much higher luminosities at the neutrino factories, but the solid angle coverage of the detectors is worse, and I think those compensate to make it pretty comparable to CHARM. There's a possibility cosmic rays are sort of marginally observable here. These guys have a paper claiming that it's a very relevant constraint. I couldn't tell whether it's covering the whole region or not. And then the last thing I'll mention in this long-lived context is that what I was saying earlier, that even these things that I've talked about as prompt for big-ish epsilon can be long-lived for small epsilon. So if we talk about epsilons around 10 to the minus 7, or we talk about low masses, then there are all kinds of beam dump constraints on just this prompt decay mode. And these would move around, but actually get bigger, not smaller, if we were to talk about these slightly longer lived, but still parametrically epsilon squared kinds of decays. So this, to me, the fact that this region and this region for the epsilon to the fourth decays are very well studied by past experiments was very reassuring, because it means that one can operate on compact distance scales, do experiments that aren't the size of the Earth, and probe most of the physics that's left. So that's very good. There's one in terms of prospects. There's one beam dump experiment that we proposed the paper with BJ, that there, where you use basically some pretty small scale thing around 10 centimeters to a meter long shield and run at low rate. Just look for anything here. It was sort of left out of the past experiments. I don't know that if somebody has exactly the right equipment to do it, they could do it very quickly and easily. So it could be within a year. There are institutions that are interested in looking at it, but nobody really has a firm proof of concept, so I don't know whether that's on the future time scale or not.
What's the nature of the supernova constraint?
So this is really only relevant for when it's the vector itself that's long-lived. But the point is that the lifetime and the interaction cross-section are both set by epsilon squared. So this is just like the supernova constraints on axions, that you have, you know that most of the energy from supernova 1987A went into neutrinos, and in this whole range, you would be copiously, you would be producing much more energy in these A primes, and they would be able to escape the supernova and then decay, so that would be a much more efficient energy loss mechanism.
Naively, it looks like the E137 is going to close off the M80 dark matter range. Is there a loophole there, or some reason why that was not considered?
Well, sorry, in the MEV dark matter range, does vector also decay to L plus L minus? Or?
Yeah.
So, yeah, probably. I haven't thought about it specifically.
LSMD is better suited for that. You produce a lot more vectors, and they decay to MEV dark matter, and dark matter scatters and in the neutrino detector, creating analog neutral currents. So
this is an
This is a constraint. They saw no candidate events. They analyzed 30
At the level of thousands of events, I mean, there are no such events, right? So, and you know, your vanilla kind of MEV dark matter creates millions of events. So at that level, there is no need to do any analysis.
All right, so now I will talk quickly about some of the things that we can do at shorter lifetimes. So starting from flavor factories and fixed target, here this longest to smallest length argument breaks down because they're all probing, you know, anything from prompt to long-lived. To prompt to the sort of 10 centimeter gamma C tau region. And then I'll also talk a little bit about LHC production and Tevatron, which depend on more assumptions, like whether you have low-scale supersymmetry. For the most interesting processes, it really depends on whether you have low-energy supersymmetry. But if you do and it's light enough, it can be spectacular. We don't know what's going to happen. So once you're talking about things that decay relatively quickly, you can't either use the sun's natural shield or build a shield to stop standard model processes, because it would stop your decay products too. And the sort of driving principle for thinking about this kind of search is, how do you control the backgrounds? There's roughly three kinds of handles that you can use. You can use exotic final states to cut down the background. There's not a lot of standard model production of 6 leptons with resonances or 4 leptons with resonances. You can use displaced vertices, or you can just shoot a lot of power at the problem. Flavor factories do some of all of those, but especially can take advantage of the first two. Fixed target is not as good at seeing the really complicated decay modes, but absolutely rocks the socks off of any dream of having high power. So I'll talk about colliders first. As you see, for reasonably high epsilon, the figure of merit for production is cross-section over center mass energy squared. Is the intensity luminosity over center mass energy squared. With extra powers of alpha and epsilon squared controlling the cross-section, So for epsilon of 10 to the minus 2, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of events in their data sets. These are big enough data sets that you still really have to look for these events to know that they're not there. You could have tens of thousands hiding there that just haven't been analyzed. And you know, many people I've talked to have said that they wouldn't have been seen as byproducts in other analyses. Both B factories and Chloe by factory have extremely high sensitivity, actually comparable, even though the integrated luminosity of Chloe is much smaller, because the center of mass energy is a factor of 10 smaller. It can have comparable reaches. Production cross sections as high as a picobard when you have when you have luminosities of an inverse Addo barn are pretty damn good. It's just making the point again. So we can see 100 events down to about this horizontal line in either plot. So down to about epsilon of 10 to the minus 4. This is just showing what you'd expect with different kinds of model assumptions if you normalize the cross section to gamma. So again, for anything above a GEV, if you have prompt decay modes, you should, and you're normal, you have a big enough epsilon to see, to explain a gamma signal with an elastic dark matter, just as one assumption you might be interested in, then you should see it. Of course, producing 100 events isn't enough when you have a large background, but when you're talking about distinctive final states, like this, or like this Higgs prime Strelung, which can be 6 leptons or 2 leptons plus mystic energy, then hundreds of events are very good. And the figure of merit for B factory reach is that they can get down to epsilons times appropriate coefficients around 10 to the minus 4 for these events. In addition to these continuum modes, you can also look at rare meson decays, which tend to be a fairly clean environment, and there are lots of mesons of which we've produced about 10 to the 10, and they have 10 to the minus 4 branching fractions to L plus L minus, and you can look for resonances in these set limits. Now, and again, there's a possibility of looking at decays that also involve these exotic final states, then you can get 10 to the minus 4-ish sensitivity. But if you're looking at the simplest direct decay, a prime to L plus L minus, you always have a lot of background to contend with. There's a very simple relation that just sets an upper bound to the signal to background of these experiments. Because any diagram I can write down for the production of the A prime through kinetic mixing, I can write down a rival diagram with no kinetic mixing and just an off-shell photon. Right? So I have some process, it produces other stuff in an A prime through kinetic mixing with a photon, because L plus L minus. Or I could have just had exactly the same set of diagrams with just an off-shell photon producing L plus L minus pair. The ratio of these, signal over background, in a width mass window delta M, is just 3 pi over 2 alpha, coming from the three-body phase states, times an epsilon squared penalty for the coupling, times the mass window that you're considering over delta M. So one can often achieve sort of percentage mass resolutions. This buys you 10 to the minus 2. So this is around, this is sort of a big factor. Should also divide by the number of flavors it can decay to. This typically gives you things like 5, 10 to the 4 epsilon squared, but you see that that for epsilons around 10 to the minus 3, this is already becoming a few percent signal over background. When you're talking about a few percent signal, 100 events isn't quite good enough anymore, so all of the limits are on the level of epsilons of 10 to the minus 3. So one analysis has already been done. This gray region here was a Babar search. They weren't looking for dark photons. They weren't looking for the A prime. They were looking for this decays to a pseudoscalar and a photon. But that has the same final state, and one can pretty convincingly, in my opinion, interpret it as a limit on this corner of parameter space. Two of the other most sensitive experiments to think about are KTEV and CLOE, which might be able to extend the reach to this level. KTEV, I think, has a really good chance of making it to this curve with if they analyzed their data, because they have a beautiful data set from studying pi zero to just e plus e minus, which is a tiny branching fraction, and had very much the same background. So we really know what their sensitivity is. For CLOE, this is more of a guess because they have a lot of conversion backgrounds that might actually dominate over the irreducible one I wrote there. But probably they can reach, you know, beneath 2×10⁻³ 2 sigma sensitivity over a wide range of masses below the muon threshold. Babar has problems going below the muon threshold, but above this, if they were to analyze their whole data set, they could improve their sensitivity by factors of 2 to 3. And there's also a group at Babar that's actively pursuing these more exotic final states. One paper has already come out, which sets limits on epsilon times mixing angles around 10⁻⁴ through this 4-lepton channel that I drew over here. Of course, this was mostly done not because 4 leptons is the most relevant final state in the world, but it was the simplest of these final states for them to start with, trying to understand there's ongoing work on multiple different combinations involving late decays, involving 6 leptons or 2 leptons plus missing energy, and so on. So there's a lot of interest from the flavor factories. We had many representatives at the workshop who are all thinking about setting these various constraints. And some of these limits will probably, or discoveries should be seen in the next year or two. So, all right, I said I advertised the statistics of fixed target experiments. There's basically two reasons that they have much higher statistics. There's the obvious one that you're colliding a bunch of electrons into a fixed slab of material instead of into a small bunch of positrons. And there's also a higher cross-section. So, sorry, let me skip forward. There's been a serious effort at largely with physicists at SLAC and at JLab are the ones that we've been involved with, to develop fixed target experiments that can really max out on this sensitivity. And part of that means dealing with as high of a flux of background events as possible, so that you can accumulate a large number of signal events as well and just beat down the statistics in these high background modes. So they need extremely good mass resolution because that goes in the denominator in that formula over there. Very good forward coverage because the production of this gauge boson is peaked at extremely forward angles, not just the sort of mass over energy that you would expect from phase space alone, but actually mass over energy to the free Hubbs power. This is coming from the fact that just the kinematics of the intermediate state particles in these diagrams favors A primes that carry the vast majority of the beam energy. This is different from some of the, this is the same as this diagram that I wrote down here with the gamma star. But it's very different from all the other QED backgrounds. So it's an extremely useful property to isolate this signal in its irreducible background. And you get a sort of picture-perfect event. So you have a very forward-going A prime. It decays to a roughly symmetric pair of leptons. You can reconstruct the mass, and the recoil electron goes off in another direction. So the challenges are taking in as much data as possible to get statistics, and dealing with all of the other stuff that goes in the forward direction from the beam. And there's two proposals in this direction that Philip Rubin and I have been very involved with Bogdan Wojciechowski, who is at JLab. He suggested that we think about experiments at the Hall A spectrometer. And so he's a member of the Hall A collaboration and has a lot of experience with this. Basically, they have two spectrometers. One is set to accept electrons at a very particular angle and a very particular set of momenta. The other one is set to accept positrons at a very particular angle and range of momenta. And so it's very easy to set these at symmetrical points and just accept lots of these events, our A prime events, and if there are any, and the irreducible background. Because you can tune the momenta, you can do a very good job of reducing the irreducible reducing all of the additional QED backgrounds. So that we're really left with the sort of A prime candidate events. This one's coming from a single off-shell photon. And this thing operates at very high currents. The acceptance for A prime events is only 10 to the minus 3, but that's still ample to make a good order of magnitude improvement in cross-section reach. So this is where we estimate that this can get to. There's a proposal that we're planning to put into JLab this weekend.
This is a plot.
From our proposal, the most model-independent set of axis available, right? Because this could be an E minus tau gauge boson that just happens to have an intrinsic coupling of 10 to the minus 7 times alpha. Why not? If it were there, which I think is much less likely, we would see it too. There's also a parasitic proposal that's been developed extensively by a group at SLAC. All of the halls at JLab are occupied, but there's a little bunker underneath Hall B where they dump electrons once they're done using them to produce a photon beam. And there's actually space in this bunker to produce a fairly nice experiment. With assumptions that seem feasible, you could get a sensitivity, I just changed the axis in epsilon, down to 10 to the minus 5. With this experiment, at least in some mass window where the vertexing works. Now, this is really for a particular setting. There's a lot of small modifications to the experiment that one can make, that will be forced to make if you're running parasitically. Like, they're going to change the beam energy from time to time. As they lower the beam energy from this nominal value in the upper hall where they're using the photons, you get also these blobs move to the left. And the lower blob, so this lower blob is based on using vertexing to reduce the background. This vertexing blob can get a lot bigger as you move to the left, to lower masses, which are accessible at lower energies. Higher current or wider angle and higher energies let you push either downward or sort of off to the right with this blob. And right now, we're talking about a silicon strip detector, but if one were to invest in a silicon pixel detector, you could get much higher vertex precision, and this blob would just expand this direction and fill in an open space around here. There is another experiment that I wanted to mention, a proposal for the free electron laser at JLab. I should say these past two are sort of 6 GeV beam proposals. This one is for the free electron laser, which is 100, and I think they want to run below the pion threshold, so order 100 MeV. beam. And they'll just have electrons hitting a hydrogen target. Want to design a sort of full acceptance collider-like detector. And they'll be sensitive to sort of lower region of epsilon. So here's a cartoon where I've imagined the extending this whole B reach that I showed you, that red curve, to lower energies, could fill in this. That's a real experiment that needs new equipment. Cheap equipment, possibly borrowed equipment in most cases, but still equipment that isn't all in the same place and will therefore take some time. This Hall A experiment takes in 24 days of beam, could actually happen on the 1 year time scale. You're using existing detectors and proven technologies, so if this gets approved, the data could be on tape by the summer of 2010. Further improvements, basically, if you can take something with a higher acceptance, like this Hall B design, and stick it in a higher current environment, or if you use pixels, all of this additional region could conceivably be covered. This definitely isn't a 1 year time scale, but could be much less than five if there's a push. And this, really, from here down, I think is a particularly interesting region because this is where sort of the nicely theoretically motivated scenarios with D-term generation of the mass and the gamma inelastic dark matter cross section all sort of suggest, there's a lot of model dependence, but they all sort of suggest this region here. And this Hall A would be really the first experiment to probe that region below 1 GeV. Obviously, further experiments could go much farther. All right, actually, should I talk about hadron colliders, or should I just stop? I'm already going a little late.
Maybe
I can show one picture.
Maybe quickly do the hadron
colliders. All right. So hadron colliders are great because because if you have SUSY production, cross-section independent of, then the cross-section is, of course, independent of epsilon. It's just garden variety, standard model superpartner production. But the branching fraction to this dark sector could be order one. And so you end up with no dependence on epsilon producing these crazy events where you have missing energy coming off in the case of neutralino production, missing energy plus jets in the case of, say, squark or gluino production. And in addition, you're producing these very light states. They're very boosted, so when they decay, you get some number of leptons in a very collimated jet. The only dependence on epsilon is in the lifetime, just whether they decay in the detector or not. So it's very complementary to the direct production methods that I mentioned earlier. There are a lot of experimentalists working on it. Most of them are at the LHC rather than the Tevatron, which may make this a somewhat longer-term effort. But the sort of in-principle limitation here is now a totally differently shaped contour. It's just that the lifetime has to be short. Conceivably, things as low as this green line upward could all be probed. Let's see. There are two results that are relevant for this and put a damper on my excitement about discoveries at the Tevatron. So Yuri Gerstein and Andy Haas have both looked for very similar signatures. Yuri's been looking for electron pairs plus a photon. These are both D0 analyses. Andy Haas was doing a Higgs search for muons, but he was sensitive to lepton jets as well. And in this case of the simple decay mode, found only two candidate events, not at the same masses at all. So apparently, we are not copiously producing things.
We discovered two things.
Four, actually. actually, because the mass of one muon pair is different from the mass of the other muon pair in both cases.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Cool. Very exciting.
All right. I'll end there with the Copious discovery.
Questions for Natalia?
I think one thing that is worth emphasizing with the Haas analysis is that H2AA is actually not the A2 muons is more powerful than one might think, because it's not, it didn't assume that A goes to muon 100% of the time. It took the actual branching ratios for certainly for mu to tau. He also had an analysis for mu to tau, so the bound on the cross section is actually very good. It's not just
yeah.
Can you go back to the limit plot for 1 second? So the brown is what's dead now.
No. This is what will be dead if our proposal is. That's gray. Yes. Gray is dead.
That's gray.
Yeah.
What about this K along to mu plus mu minus gamma at K tau? They have a significant sample of events, and upper part of your brown square over there will be probably probable.
Yeah. Well. So. Okay. When I looked at it.
Well, it's they have maybe 10,000 of events, so you know, I looked at it briefly, but you know, somebody has to go back and do the analysis.
Yeah. So sorry. So in the
it's not exactly the active collaboration anymore. Yes. Right?
In the first plot I showed associated with this Hall A, the non-cartoon one, my thought was that the Chloe search would actually be more sensitive. They're very comparable, but that the Chloe phi decay search would actually be more sensitive than the K long. So I listed that one. But as you see,
different experiment differences.
I agree. So there's I tried to draw what I thought were the limiting ones. Certainly other experiments analyzing their data can probe some region that looks roughly like these light contours.
So this the green one?
This
from
green
the
one is the pion, yeah.
Can be extended much more.
This is their limit. This is their limit. I analyzed, look, we know exactly what their data is from the E plus E minus
right.
paper. This is the limit that you get using that data. So
maybe I'm wrong by a factor of 10. Okay.
Now, Natalia, can you go back to the cartoon?
Yeah.
It says, is there any hope for discovery ever, or is it intent that things are going to...
Sir, can you tell me what the A prime mass and coupling
right.
are?
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, trial factors means that even if you saw some huge excess, you'd be like, it wouldn't be nearly as significant as what you're now with.
The trials factors mean that 5 sigma isn't 5 sigma, but it's still 7 or 8 sigma is, you know, 5 sigma significance. Right, we're talking about thousands of bins, not millions of bins. So there's certainly discovery potential, and this is a log scale, so the discovery potential of this experiment in particular, which is the most on shell, or the least virtual of these experiments, but also the smallest region. This one definitely has discovery sensitivity beyond the limits of the B factory and KTEV and Chloe potential by about the ratio of the sort of discoverable signal here to the limits that you could hope for if all that data gets analyzed.
Which ones of them are potentially scalable? I mean, if you've got 3, 4 sigma, then obviously you will have less of a problem getting more data. So
I mean, well, it's easy to go up from 24 days. So I would say this is extremely scalable.
Especially because that one was limited by acceptance, right? So
yeah.
If you actually had reason to do better, you could do much better.
So if you see evidence in this experiment, you just run for more time. If you just want to do better and build a whole new experiment, you can do, you know, potentially down to this line. These are a little, this is a little harder to scale just because it's one, you know, big wide acceptance experiment. You can't really up the current without killing it. We're already talking about a month to a year time scales, integration times.
Sorry, but running for more time is just fighting as a fourth power, right,
That's true. But also, I mean, it's certainly something like this. This is particularly scalable because really the amount of time we're talking about at a particular sensitivity to a particular mass is 4 days.
Oh, I see.
Right? So 4 days.
Right. Once you start seeing something,
you can run for.
What exactly is the current status and when the decision is being made about whether this is going to happen?
Well, the proposal is due this Monday. The PAC is having a meeting in January, and the decision timescale is up to them. So.
And Ruben is flying out too.
Yeah, Ruben is sacrificing direct detection Olympics time to go for a very direct detection Olympics.
Okay. All right, thank you for you.